This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Abandoned in Death by J.D. Robb. Narrated for you by Susan Erickson. Mother is the name for God in the lips and hearts of little children. William Makepeace Thackeray. Though this be madness, yet there is method in't. William Shakespeare. 1. Before. The decision to kill herself brought her peace. Everything would be quiet and warm and soft. She could sleep, just sleep, forever. Never again would she hide in the dark when the landlord banged on the door for the rent she couldn't pay, or climb out a window again to take off. Again. She wouldn't have to give blowjobs to some sweaty John to buy food, or the pills. The pills she needed more than food. The pills that made everything quiet, even the pain. Maybe she'd even go to heaven, like it looked in the books in Bible study, where everything was fluffy white clouds and golden light and everyone smiled. Maybe she'd go to hell, with all the fire and the screaming and eternal damnation. Taking a life, even your own, was a big sin, according to the Reverend Horace Greenspan, the recipient of her first BJ, payment and penance, when he'd caught her lip-locked with Wayne Kyle Ribbett and Wayne Kyle's hand under her shirt. The experience had taught her at age 12, it was better to receive than give payment for such tedious services. Still, suicide ranked as a bigger sin than blowing some grunting asshole for traveling money or a handful of oxy. So maybe she'd go to hell. But wasn't she there already? Sick. Half the time sick, and her skin on fire. Sleeping in her car more often than in a bed. Driving from one crap town to the next. Trading sex in steamy alleys for pills. It wasn't going to get better. Not ever. She'd finally accepted that. So she'd take the pills. Enough of the pills, so the quiet went on and on and on. But before she did, she had to decide whether to take her little boy with her. Wouldn't he be better off, too? She shifted her gaze to the rearview mirror to watch him. He sat in his grubby Spider-Man PJs, half asleep as he munched from a bag of Fritos she'd grabbed from a machine when she'd pumped all but the last few dollars of her money into the gas tank. They kept him quiet, and she needed the quiet. She hadn't had time, or just hadn't thought, to grab anything when she'd scooped him out of bed. She had money, nearly gone now, and pills, far too few of them, stuffed in her purse. They didn't have much anyway, and what they did have she'd shoved into a trash bag weeks before. She had another couple of outfits for the kid, nothing clean. But she'd nearly gotten busted trying to lift a t-shirt and jeans for him from a Walmart in Birmingham. If she got busted, they'd take her kid. And he was the only thing completely hers. She'd wanted the best for him, hadn't she? She'd tried, hadn't she? 5 years of trying, after the asshole who got her pregnant told her to fuck off. She'd done her best, but it wasn't enough. Never enough. And the kid was no prize, she had to admit. Whiny and clingy, Christ knew, carrying on so she'd lost babysitters when she'd tried serving drinks or stripping it off in some hellhole. But she loved the little son of a bitch, and he loved her.
I'm thirsty, Mommy!
Thirsty, hungry, tired, not tired, always something. She'd seen motherhood as something holy once, until she'd learned it was nothing but constant drudgery, demands, disappointments. And she wasn't good enough, just like everyone had told her all her damn life. She slowed enough to pass the bottle of cherry Coke between the seats. Drink this.
Don't like that. Don't like it. I want orange soda pop. I want it. You're a bad mommy.
Don't say that. Now, don't you say that. You know it hurts my feelings.
Bad mommy. Bad mommy. I'm thirsty.
Okay. I'll get you a drink when I find a place to stop.
Thirsty!
The wine cut through her brain like a buzzsaw.
Thirsty, no!
I know, baby darling. We'll stop soon. How about we sing a song? God, her head felt like a soggy apple full of worms. If she could be sure, absolutely sure, she'd die from it. She'd swerve into an oncoming car and be done. Instead, she started singing The Wheels on the Bus. And when he sang with her, she was, for a moment, almost happy. She'd put one of her pills in his drink. That's what she'd do. He'd sleep. She'd given him a portion of a pill before, when she'd needed him to sleep. But she'd give him a whole one. And wouldn't he just drift away to heaven? He could have a puppy and friends to play with. And all the toys he wanted. Orange soda pop by the gallon. Little boys, even bratty ones, didn't go to hell. She pulled off the highway and hunted up a 24-hour mart. She parked well back from the lights where insects swarmed in clouds. You have to stay in the car. If you don't, I can't get you a drink. You stay in the car now, you hear? Be quiet. Be good, and I'll get you some candy, too.
I want Skittles!
Then Skittles it'll be. The lights inside were so bright they burned her eyes, but she got him an orange Fanta and Skittles. She thought about sliding the candy into her purse, but she was too damn tired to bother. It left her with less than a dollar in change. But she wouldn't need money where she was going anyway. As she crossed back to the car, she dug out a pill from the zipped pocket in her purse. Thinking of puppies and toys and her baby darling giggling with the angels, she popped the tab and slipped it into the can. This was best for both of them. He smiled at her. Sweet. Sweet smile, and bounced on the seat when she came back. I love you, baby darling.
I love you, Mommy. Did you get my Skittles? Did ya? Are we going on another venture?
Yeah, I got 'em, and yeah, you bet. The biggest adventure yet. And when we get there, there'll be angels and flowers and puppy dogs.
Can I have a puppy? Can I? I want a puppy now.
You can have all the puppies. She looked back at him as he slurped some of the drink through the straw she'd stuck in the pop top. Her little toe-headed man. He'd grown inside her, come out of her. She'd given up everything for him. No one in her life had ever loved her as he did. and she'd ruined it. Windows opened to the hot, thick air, she drove, not back to the highway, but aimlessly, somewhere in Louisiana. Somewhere, but it didn't matter. She drove, just drove, with the sweaty air blowing around her, away from the strip malls, away from the lights. He sang, but after a while his voice had that sleepy slur to it. Go to sleep now, baby darling. Just go to sleep now. He'd be better off. Better off. Wouldn't he be better off? Tears tracked down her cheeks as she took a pill for herself. She'd find a place, a dark, quiet place. She'd down the rest of the pills, then climb in the back with her baby boy. They'd go to heaven together. God wouldn't take her away from her baby darling, or him from her. He'd go to heaven, so she would, too. The God in Bible study had a long white beard, kind eyes, light poured right out of his fingertips. That was the way to heaven. And she saw a light instead of the dark. It seemed to shine above a small white church sitting by itself on a little hill. Flowers bloomed around it, and grass grew neat and smooth. She could smell it all through the open window. Dazed, half dreaming, she stopped the car. This was heaven, or close enough for her baby darling. She carried him to it like an offering to the kind-eyed God with his white beard, to the angels with their spread wings and soft smiles. He stirred as she laid him down by the door, whined for her. You sleep now, my baby darling. Just sleep. She stroked him a while until he settled. He hadn't had enough of the drink, she thought. Not enough to take him all the way to those angels and puppies, but maybe this was the best. Close to heaven, under the light, with flowers all around. She walked back to the car that smelled of candy and sweat. He'd spilled the drink, she saw now, when he'd fallen asleep, and the Skittles were scattered over the back seat like colorful confetti. He was in God's hands now. She drove away. Drove and drove, with her mind floating on the drug. Happy now. No pain. So light. So light. She sang to him, forgetting he no longer sat in the back seat. Her head didn't hurt now, and her hands didn't want to shake. Not with the night wind blowing over her face, through her hair, and the pill doing its magic. Was she going to meet her friends? She couldn't quite remember. What classes did she have in the morning? It didn't matter. Nothing mattered now. When she saw the lake and the moonlight on it, she sighed. There, of course. That's where she needed to go. Like a baptism, a cleansing on the way to heaven. Thrilled, she punched the gas and drove into the water. As the car started to sink so slowly, she smiled and closed her eyes. Now, her name was Mary Kate Covino. She was 25, an assistant marketing manager at Dowell & Associates. She'd started there straight out of college and had climbed a couple of rungs since. She liked her job. She mostly liked her life, even though her jerk of a boyfriend had dumped her right before the romantic getaway she'd planned, meticulously, like a campaign. Yesterday? The day before? She couldn't be sure. Everything blurred. It was June. June something, 2061. She had a younger sister, Tara, a grad student at Carnegie Mellon. Tara was the smart one, and an older brother, Carter, the clever one. He'd just gotten engaged to Rhonda. She had a roommate, Cleo, like another sister, and they shared a two-bedroom apartment on the Lower West Side. She'd grown up in Queens, and though her parents had divorced when she'd been 11, they'd all been pretty civilized about it. Both her parents had remarried, no step-sibs, but their second round was okay. Everybody stayed chill. Her maternal grandparents, Gran and Pop, had given her a puppy for her 6th birthday. Best present ever. Lulu lived a happy life until the age of 14, when she'd just gone to sleep and hadn't woken up again. She liked to dance, liked sappy romantic vids, preferred sweet wines to dry, and had a weakness for her paternal grandmother's, Nona's, sugar cookies. She reminded herself of all this and more. Her first date, how she'd broken her ankle skiing, first and last time, every day. Multiple times a day. It was essential she remember who she was, where she came from, and all the pieces of her life. Because sometimes everything got twisted and blurred and out of sync, and she started to believe him. She'd been afraid he'd rape her, but he never touched her that way. Never touched her at all. Not when she was awake. She couldn't remember how she'd gotten here. The void opened up after Teague ditched her, and all the shouting and the bitching, her walking home from the bar, half-drunk, unhappy, berating herself for haunting the damn stupid bar he owned, putting in hours helping out 4, even 5 nights a damn stupid week. For nothing but one of his killer smiles. Then she'd woken up here, feeling sick, her head pounding, in the dark, chained up, like something in a horror vid, in a dark room with a cot. Then he'd come, the man, looking like someone's pale and bookish uncle. He turned on a single light, so she saw it was a basement, windowless, with concrete floors and walls of pargeted stone. He had sparkling blue eyes and snow-white hair. He set a tray holding a bowl of soup, a cup of tea on the cot, and just beamed at her. "You're awake. Are you feeling better, Mommy?" An accent, a twangy southern one with a child's cadence. She needed to remember that. But in the moment, she'd known only panic. She'd begged him to let her go, wept, pulled against the shackles on her right wrist, left ankle. He ignored her. Simply went to a cupboard and took out clothes. He set them, neatly folded, on the bed. "I know you haven't been feeling good, but I'm gonna take care of you. Then you'll take care of me. That's what mommies do. They take care of their little boys." While she wept, screamed, demanded to know what he wanted, begged him to let her go, he just kept smiling with those sparkling eyes. "I made you soup and tea all by myself. You'll feel better when you eat. I looked and looked for you. Now here you are, and we can be together again. You can be a good mommy." Something came into those eyes that frightened her more than the dark, than the shackles. "You're going to be a good mommy and take care of me the way you're supposed to this time. I made you soup, so you eat it, or you'll be sorry." Terrified, she eased down on the cot, picked up the spoon. It was lukewarm and bland, but it soothed her raw throat. "You're supposed to say thank you. You have to tell me I'm a good boy. Thank you. I don't know your name. She thought he'd kill her then. His face turned red, his eyes wild, his fisted hands pounded together.
I'm your baby darling. Say it. Say it.
Baby darling, I'm sorry. I don't feel well. I'm scared. I was scared when you locked me in a room so you could do ugly things with men. I was scared when you gave me things to make me sleep so you could do them. I was scared when I woke up sick and you weren't there, and it was dark, and I cried and cried. That wasn't me. Please, that wasn't me. You're older than me, so I can't be your mother. I didn't—
You go to hell for lying.
To hell with the devil and the fire. You eat your soup and drink your tea, or maybe I'll leave you all alone here like you left me. She spooned up soup. It's really good. You did a good job. Like a light switch, he beamed.
All by myself.
Thanks. There's no one here to help you?
You're here now, Mommy.
I waited a long, long time. People were mean to me, and I cried for you. But you didn't come.
I'm sorry. I couldn't find you.
How did you find me?
I found three. Three's lucky. And one will be right.
I'm tired now. It's my bedtime. When you're all better, you'll tuck me into bed like you should have before and read me a story and we'll sing songs.
He started toward the door.
The wheels on the bus go round and round.
He looked back at her. The face of a man, easily 60, singing in the voice of a child.
Good night, Mommy.
That fierceness came back into his eyes.
Say good night, baby darling.
Good night, baby darling.
He closed the door behind him. She heard locks snap into place. She heard other things in the timeless void of that windowless room. Voices, screaming, crying. Sometimes she thought the voices were her own, the screams her own, and sometimes she knew they weren't. But when she called out, no one came. Once she thought she heard banging on the wall across the room, but she was so tired. She knew he put drugs in the food, but when she didn't eat, he turned off all the lights and left her in the dark until she did. Sometimes he didn't speak with the child's voice, the accent, but with a man's. So reasonable. So definite. One night, he didn't come at all. Not with food, not to demand she change her clothes. She had three outfits to rotate. He didn't come to sit and smile that terrifying smile and ask for a song or a story. She'd die here, slowly starving to death, alone, chained, trapped, because he'd forgotten her or gotten hit by a car. But no, no, someone had to be looking for her. She had friends and family. Someone was looking for her. Her name was Mary Kate Covino. She was 25. As she went through her daily litany, she heard shouting. Him. His voice, high-pitched, like the bratty child he became when upset or angry. Then another voice. No, she realized, still his, but his man's voice. A coldly angry man's voice. And the weeping, the begging. That was female. She couldn't make out the words, just the sounds of anger and desperation. She dragged herself over to the wall, pressed against it, hoping to hear or be heard.
Please, help me! Help me! Help me! I'm here! I'm Mary Kate, and I'm here! Someone screamed. Something crashed. Then everything went quiet. She beat her fists, bloody on the wall, shouted for someone to help. The door to her prison burst open. He stood there, eyes wild and mad, his face and clothes splattered with blood, and blood still dripping from the knife in his hand. Shut up! He took a step toward her. You shut the fuck up! And another. She didn't know where it came from, but she shouted out, Baby darling! And he stopped. I heard terrible sounds, and I thought someone was hurting you. I couldn't get to you, baby darling. I couldn't protect you. Someone hurt my baby darling. She lied. Who lied, baby darling? She pretended to be mommy, but she wasn't. She called me names and tried to hurt me. She slapped my face, but I hurt her. You go to hell when you lie, so she's gone to hell. He'd killed someone. Someone like her. Killed someone with the knife and would kill her next. Through the wild fear came a cold, hard will. One to survive. Oh, my poor baby, darling. Can you take these bracelets off so I can take care of you? Some of the mad fury seemed to die out of his eyes, but a kind of shrewdness replaced it. She lied, and she's in hell. Remember what happens when you lie. Now you have to be quiet. Number one's in hell, so number two can clean up the mess. Mommy cleans up messes. Maybe you'll be lucky number three. But if you're not quiet, if you make my head hurt, you'll be unlucky. I could clean up for you. It's not your turn! He stomped out and for the first time didn't shut and lock the door. Mary Kate shuffled over as close as she could. She couldn't reach the door, but at last she could see out of it. A kind of corridor. Stone walls, concrete floor, harshly lit, and another door almost directly across from hers, bolted from the outside. Number two? Another woman? Another prisoner? She started to call out, but heard him coming back. Survive, she reminded herself, and went back to the cot, sat. He didn't have the knife now. But a tall cup. Some sort of protein shake, she thought. He'd pushed one on her before. Drugged. More drugs. Baby darling, I don't have time now. She ruined everything. You drink this because it has nutrition. Why don't I make you something to eat? You must be hungry. He looked at her, and she thought he seemed almost sane again. And when he spoke, his voice sounded calm and easy. You're not ready. When he stroked a hand over her hair, she fought not to shudder. Not nearly. But I think you will be. I hope so. She felt the quick pinch of the pressure syringe. I don't have time. You can drink this when you wake up. You have to be healthy. Lie down and go to sleep. I'm going to be very busy. She started to fade when he walked to the door and heard the bolt snap home when she melted down on the cot. He had a plan. He always had a plan. And he had the tools. With meticulous stitches, he was a meticulous man. He sewed the neck wound on the fraud. Over the wound, he fastened a wide black velvet ribbon. It looked, to his eye, rather fetching. He'd already cut her hair before bringing her, with so much hope, to this stage. Now he brushed it, used some of the product to style it properly. He'd washed her, very carefully, so not a drop of blood remained, before he'd chosen the outfit. While he worked, he had one of Mommy's songs playing. "I'm coming up," he sang along with Pink, "so you better get this party started." Once he had her dressed, he started on her makeup. He'd always loved watching her apply it, all the paints and powders and brushes. He painted her nails, fingers, and toes a bright, happy blue, her favorite color. He added the big hoop earrings, and he'd already added the other piercings, so fit studs into the second hole and the cartilage of her left ear, and the little silver bar in her navel. She'd liked shoes with high, high heels and pointy toes, even though she mostly wore tennis shoes, but he remembered how she'd looked at the high ones in store windows. And sometimes they went in so she could try them on. "Just pretending, baby darling," she'd told him. "Just playing dress up." So he'd slipped her feet into ones she'd have wished for. A little tight, but it didn't matter. And as a final tribute, spritzed her body with Party Girl, her favorite scent. When he was done, when he'd done his very best, he took a picture of her. He'd frame it, keep it to remind him. "You're not Mommy, but I wanted you to be. You shouldn't have lied, so you have to leave. If you hadn't, we could have been happy." Number 2 and number 3 were sleeping. He hoped number 2 had learned a lesson. You had to learn your lessons when he'd made her clean up the mess. Tomorrow, he'd cut her hair the right way and give her the tattoo and the piercings, and she'd see all she had to do was be a good mommy and stay with him always, take care of him always, and they'd be happy forever. But the fake mommy had to leave. He rolled her out on the gurney, a man with a plan, out through the door and into the garage. After opening the cargo doors, he rolled her, with some effort, up the ramp and into the van. He secured the gurney, couldn't have it rolling around, then got behind the wheel. Though it was disappointing, he'd known he would probably go through more than one before finding the right one, so he already knew where to take her. He drove carefully out of the garage and waited until the doors rumbled down closed behind him. It had to be far enough away from the home he and Mommy would make so the police didn't come knocking to ask questions, but not so far away he had to take too much time getting there. Accidents happened. It had to be quiet, with no one to see. Even at this time of night in New York, you had to know where to find quiet. So the little playground seemed perfect. Children didn't play at 3 in the morning. No, they did not. Even if they had to sleep in the car because the mean landlord kicked them out, they didn't play so late. He parked as close as he could and worked quickly. He wore black coveralls and booties over his shoes, a cap that covered his hair. He'd sealed his hands, but wore gloves, too. Nothing showed, nothing at all. He rolled the gurney right up to the bench where good mommies would watch their children play in the sunshine. He laid her on it like she was sleeping and put the sign he'd made with construction paper and black crayon over her folded hands. It said what she was. Bad Mommy. He went back to the van and drove away. Drove back and into the garage, into the house. He had the house because she'd left him. He had the house because she'd given him the deed and the keys and the codes and everything, But he didn't want everything. He only wanted one thing. His mommy. In the quiet house, he changed into his pajamas. He washed his hands and face and brushed his teeth like a good boy. In the glow of the nightlight, he climbed into bed. He fell asleep with a smile on his face and dreamed the dreams of the young and innocent. 2. In the shallow light just before dawn, Lieutenant Eve Dallas badged through the police barriers to study the body on the bench. A tall woman and lean with it, Eve took in the details. The position and condition of the body, the distance of the bench from the street, from buildings. A faint breeze stirred air that, while morning cool, teased of summer. It fluttered around Eve's cap of choppy brown hair and stirred some cheerful scent from a concrete barrel of flowers by the bench. For once, her partner had beaten her to the scene, but then Detective Peabody lived only blocks away. Peabody, in her pink coat and cowboy boots, heaved out a sigh. Really close to home. Yeah. Eve judged the victim as mid-20s, Caucasian female. She lay peacefully and fully dressed with her hands folded over a childish sign that deemed her a bad mommy. Run it down for me, Eve said. First on scene, responded to a flag down at approximately 0645. A female licensed companion got out of a cab on the corner, walked down toward her apartment. Peabody pointed west. When she passed the bench, she saw the victim. She assumes sidewalk sleeper and states that since she had a really good night, she was going to leave a few bucks on the bench. And when she started to, realized not sleeping. Started to tag 911, then saw the cruiser make the turn, so she flagged the cops down. We've got all her info, so Officer Stepp escorted her home. Did you ID the Vic? Lauren Elder, age 26. She lived on West 17th. Cohab, Roy Marsden, filed a missing persons on her 10 days ago. She tended bar at Arnold's, upper-class bar on West 14th Street. I've been there. She didn't come home from work the night of May 28th. Detective Norman, out of the 4-3, caught it. TOD? COD? Hadn't gotten that far. McNabb, here he comes. Eve glanced over to see Peabody's main dish, Electronic Detectives Division's hotshot, jog toward them. The strengthening sun couldn't hold a candle to the orange glow tea under a floppy knee-length jacket the color of irradiated plums, matched with baggies of mad colors that might have been spray-painted by insane toddlers. His sunny ponytail swung. His forest of ear hoops sparkled. No cams on this area, he told them. Low security. Quiet neighborhood. Sorry. Since you're here, you can knock on doors with the first on scene. See if anyone saw her dumped here. With her record on, Eve crouched, opened her field kit. Victims identified as Elder, Lauren, female, age 26, missing since May 28, and held against her will by the look of the marks on her right wrist and left ankle. Her clothes appear undisturbed. If there was sexual assault, the killer dressed her again. Frowning, Eve sniffed, leaned closer, sniffed again. She's wearing perfume. Full makeup, too, Peabody commented. Perfect makeup. And her hair's unmussed. Yeah, nail polish looks fresh. A woman held against her will isn't usually so worried about appearance. He fixed her up. That's how it went. Bad mommy. She doesn't look like a mom, does she? More like the let's party type. Maybe mommy's a sexual deal here. Frowning again, she pulled out micro goggles, bent down to the midriff exposed by the short glittery top. This belly bar thing? I think that's recent. It's still a little red. ME to confirm, but that looks fresh to me. Why does anyone stick holes in their navels? If I had those abs... Eve spared Peabody a glance. Odds are she didn't get a choice about the piercing. With one finger, Eve loosened the black ribbon. Or having her throat cut.
Jesus! He stitched her back up!
And carefully. Definitely the dump spot. He didn't do all this to her here. And there's your COD. She took out a gauge. TOD 2220. Perfume stronger up by the throat. Let's see if we can get a sample for the lab. I'm betting there's product in her hair. With a sealed finger, Peabody touched the victim's hair. Yeah, it's got setting gel, maybe spray, too, to hold that spiky style. We've got Harvo, queen of hair and fiber. She'll nail that down. Our perp left us a lot. We can ID the makeup, any hair gunk, maybe the nail polish. Let's find out if these are her clothes, because maybe not. Curious, she pried off one of the shoes. A little tight. Not her size. Same polish on the toes, and perfect. She's really clean, too. No way you can be shackled for over a week and stay this clean and shiny. So he washed her. Maybe they can ID what he used on her. I'm not seeing any other injuries. Nothing to indicate he knocked her around. Peabody secured a swab, bagged it. Let's turn her over. Together, they rolled the body. Tattoo, lower back. A big butterfly, blue with yellow markings. This is fresh too, Peabody. It can't be more than a few days old. It's not all the way healed. It looks professional. I mean, it sure doesn't look like a home job. A way of branding her? Peabody wondered. The tat, the piercing? Maybe. Making her into some image. This is what I want, so this is how you'll look. Is she blonde in her ID shot? Yeah, but her hair's longer, past her chin. Smooth bob in the ID shot. Peabody shook back her own dark hair with the red tips, brought up the photo on her PPC, and see? The makeup's more subtle, more natural. Nothing on here, since I'm looking for identifying marks like a tat. Image somewhere in the perp's head, Eve concluded, and she was adjusted to fit it. Her next of kin's in Flatbush. Eve scanned the details on Peabody's handheld. Both parents. We'll take the wit, the cohab, then do the notification. Let's call in the sweepers and the morgue, then we'll get a follow-up statement from the LC. Eve stepped back, looked at the playground, the climbing things, the sliding things, the spinning things. This is going to be Bella's playground when Mavis and Leonardo move into the new house. And you and McNabb. Hell, number two kid when it gets here. Yeah, like I said, close to home. Eve's eyes narrowed. We're gonna bust the killer's ass for murder. And we're gonna bust it for screwing with Bella's playground. The witness couldn't add anything, so they drove to the victim's apartment. Decent security, Eve noted, studying the building. She bypassed the buzzers, mastered through the locks into a small lobby. Clean. We're going to three. And ignoring the set of elevators, took the stairs. She worked at Arnold's 4 years. Peabody read off the data as they climbed. College before that, hospitality major, busted for disorderly conduct twice. Looks like college protests. No marriages. This was her first official cohab. Parents, married 29 years in Flatbush. She was the oldest of three. Brothers, age 24 and 20. Oldest is in grad school, youngest in college, and both list their primary address with their parents. Eve heard the mumble of morning shows behind closed doors when they came out on three. Otherwise, the floor was nearly as quiet as the stairway. She pressed the buzzer on 305. No palm plate, no door cam, she noted, but solid locks and a Judas hole. She saw the shadow pass over the peep. Those locks snapped open quickly. Roy Marsden stood about 6'2" in bare feet. He wore suit pants and a dress shirt, still untucked, and held a mug that smelled like fake coffee. He wore his gold-streaked black hair in short dreads that crowned his raw-boned, dark-skinned face. His eyes, wide, deep, latched onto Eve's. He said, "Lauren." "Mr. Marsden, I'm Lieutenant Dallas. I know who you are. I've seen you in court. I saw the vid. I know who you are." "Lauren. God, Lauren, say it fast. Please, say it fast." She'd already broken his world, Eve thought, and said it fast. "I regret to inform you Lauren Elder is dead." His hand went limp. Instinctively, Eve reached out, grabbed the mug before the contents spilled. "Can we come in?" I knew, but I hoped. I kept thinking, she's so strong and smart and... But I knew, because she'd never just... I need to... He turned, walked to one of the two chairs in a compact living area. A ruthlessly clean one with a small sofa, a few tables, a lot of street art. A pair of windows, uncurtained but privacy screened, looked out over the street. He sat, seemed to shrink into himself, then got up again to circle the room. "I can't. Just can't. I need Mr. Marsden." Peabody spoke gently. "Could I get you some water?" No, nothing. "Lauren. Lauren." She didn't come home. She didn't answer her link. Buddy said she'd left at 2:30. Night shift. She had the night shift, so I was sleeping, and it was morning before I knew she didn't come home. I went to bed, and she didn't come home. He turned back, those wide, deep eyes full of tears. "I was sleeping." Not shock, Eve thought, because some part of him had known, but grief, overwhelming. "Can we sit down, Roy?" "I should have waited up." "It wouldn't have mattered." Taking his arm, Eve led him back to the chair. She set his coffee on the table beside him, took the second chair. "I'm sorry for your loss, Roy. And we're going to do everything we can to find who hurt Lauren. We need your help." "It's only a few blocks to walk. We got this place because it's only a few blocks." "How long have you lived here?" Peabody asked, though she'd already read the data.
6 months. We started seeing each other a year ago, a year in March, and we got this place together.
He shut his eyes, ignored the tears that tracked down his cheeks.
"Doesn't matter. She matters."
What happened? What happened to Lauren?
You're a law student? Eve asked.
Yeah. I'm working at Delroy, Gilby, and Associates this summer, and taking a couple of night classes so I can get my degree this fall.
What kind of law?
Criminal. I want to work for the PA. I want to prosecute criminals.
Heat burned through the tears.
Now more than ever. I know I have to pull myself together. I know I have to answer questions. I know how this part works, but please, please, tell me what happened to Lauren.
If you understand how this works, you know we're in the very beginning stages of the investigation. We can surmise Lauren was abducted on the night of May 28th. You filed the missing persons report.
Detective Norman.
Yes, and we'll coordinate with him.
He said she left the bar like Buddy said. They were the last ones. They closed. And they left, and he walked to the subway, and she started home. Buddy wouldn't hurt her, okay? He's a friend. And they checked. They checked the cams in the subway and everything. And he, the detective, couldn't find anybody who saw her after.
He would have asked, but I'm asking. Do you know of anyone who'd want to hurt her?
An ex?
No.
I mean, she dated before me. But we've been together more than a year and people move on. She wasn't stressed about anything or anyone. She never said anything about somebody bothering her or watching her. There was nothing. She'd have told me.
He picked up the coffee, set it down again.
Did he? They.
Was she raped?
The medical examiner will determine that, but she was fully dressed.
What was she wearing when she went to work?
Detective Norman asked that. They have a kind of uniform at Arnold's, so black pants, a white shirt. She wore her black low tops because she's on her feet behind the bar.
Jewelry?
I gave her a ring when we moved in. Not like an engagement ring because we weren't ready for that, but a silver band, a thumb ring, so that, and a wrist unit. Her parents gave her a nice one last Christmas.
She isn't much for a lot of it, but she usually wore those little ruby studs shaped like hearts. Rubies are birthstone, and her grandparents gave them to her when she turned 21.
One for each ear?
Yeah.
She's kind of conservative.
So, no other piercings? No tats?
Lauren?
A ghost of a smile came and went.
Oh, no.
Wait!
He jerked up.
Maybe it's not her. You're not sure it's Lauren?
I'm sorry. We're sure.
How?
I mean, how did she die?
What did they do to her?
I'm not going to fall apart again, okay? I need to know.
There were abrasions and lacerations on one of her wrists and one of her ankles that indicate she was restrained for some time. My on-scene examination indicates a severe neck wound caused her death.
They cut her throat.
He closed his eyes, then covered his face.
One second. Give me a second.
Her family. I have to tell her family. We talk every day.
They're going crazy. And I have to tell them.
We're going to notify her family when we leave here. It's best if we tell them.
Could we see the bedroom?
The bedroom?
Oh, sure. I have a little office, too. It's more of a closet, but you can look in there. I can open the comp for you. You can look at anything that will help.
We appreciate that.
He rubbed his eyes.
Eve saw his shoulders tremble before he stiffened them.
I need to contact my supervisor. She gave me her personal contact when Lauren went missing. I need to tell her I'm not coming in.
That's fine.
When can I see her? When can we, her family and I, see her?
I'll let you know as soon as that's cleared. Roy, the ME?
She couldn't be in better hands.
I remember from the vid, and I've seen him in court, too. You'll find who did this. You'll find who treated her this way.
When they left, Eve had a good sense of her victim. Lauren Elder had close family ties. Her mother had done several of the street scenes on the walls, and she kept a photo of her family on her dresser. A beach vacation scene from the background, and with everyone mugging for the camera. She'd kept her clothes, a little on the conservative side, Peabody had confirmed, ordered in the closet she'd shared with her cohab. She hadn't gone for a lot of frills, a lot of sparkles. Her ambitions had run to one day owning her own bar. She'd kept a memory book of photos. Family, her circle of friends, co-workers, so loyal and sentimental. She'd lived within her means and kept a careful record of tips, considerable, which led Eve to believe she'd been good at her job. No nail polish and minimal makeup in her supply. Whoever the killer had wanted her to be, she hadn't matched the image inside. They made a nice place. Peabody settled in for the drive to Brooklyn. You can tell most of the furniture's family cast-offs, but they made it nice. I don't think he's gonna be able to stay there now. It's too much them. He's been waiting for us to knock on the door since she went missing. He wasn't ready, because you never are, but he's been waiting for us. Her family wouldn't be ready either, she thought. Contact Detective Norman. Fill him in and get his files. We'll need to talk to the staff at the bar, so let's see if we can set that up, at least to start with Buddy, since he was the last we know of who saw her. Buddy's his actual birth name. Buddy James Wilcox. Who names their kid Buddy? Buddy's parents. She had a routine, Eve continued, and whipped around a slow-moving mini. Roy said she'd had the 7 to closing shift for the last 8 months. They'd try to grab dinner together about 6, and she'd head to work by 6:45. He'd head to his night class at the same time, except for Sundays when they both had off, Mondays for her and Saturdays for him. Some Saturdays he'd hang out at the bar for a while, but mostly he studied. Work nights. She walked home between 2:15 and 2:30. Same route. 3 blocks north, 1 east. She was nabbed on that route. Did he get lucky, or did he know her routine? He knew. That's how I see it. She was a type he wanted. Need to consult with Mira, but that's what plays. Her age, coloring, build. Something about her hit the marks, and he could do the rest with the clothes, the tat, the hair. He kept her for 10 days, Peabody added. Plenty of time to make those adjustments. The tat, at least, is fresher than 10 days, I think. A good-sized tat, with detail, Peabody pointed out. Had to take a couple of hours. Precise work. Maybe a pro. But is she gonna stay still while you're poking all those needles into her flesh? Even the thought of it had Eve's back muscles quivering. You could strap her down, but there'd be movement if she was conscious. I'm gonna get a tat. In reflex, Eve nearly hit the brakes. What? Why? What? Not right now, this minute. I have to decide on what and where. Just a little one. Peabody held up her thumb and index finger to indicate an inch or two.
I'm down to the back of my shoulder or my ankle. Something girly, maybe.
Something girly carved into your living flesh. Forever. That's why it has to be the exact right symbol or image.
Tiny needles injecting ink into your body, which you pay for on purpose. Maybe a thistle. Scottish symbol, because McNab. But maybe a rainbow.
You could do two rainbows, one on each ass cheek.
Or a crescent moon with a little star,
Peabody continued, unperturbed.
Those are my top contenders right now. It's a big decision.
Yeah, paying someone to pump ink into your skin's a big one. Now let's move on from voluntary self-mutilation and back to murder.
Self-expression. Body art.
Whatever. The entire conversation just weirded her out. Murder, at least, Eve understood. We'll see what Elder's talk says. But I think it's a safe bet she was drugged for a good portion of those 10 days. Still, you need a nice private place to do all of that. You need transport.
Private residence or exceptional soundproofing in a multi-unit. With a multi-unit, you'd need a private entrance, some place to keep a vehicle, maybe a private garage for the whole deal.
Did she know the killer? From the bar, her old neighborhood, her new one? He rolls up. Hey, Lauren. Bartenders are usually friendly types. It's part of the job. But why would she willingly get in a vehicle when she's only blocks from home?
Check the weather the night she went missing. Otherwise, maybe he lured her in.
Hey, Lauren, take a look at this. Or he's parked along the route. Maybe looks like he needs help with something.
Or just grabs.
He got her into the vehicle. No head wounds that showed on scene, but if he bashed her, that could have healed up. And Morris will find it.
Jabbed her with a drug, that's more likely.
Jab, load her in, drive away. Eve played it out like a vid in her head. It wouldn't take half a minute.
Partly cloudy, no precipitation, low of 62 on May 28th.
Peabody lowered her PPC.
Not the kind of night you'd jump into a vehicle for a couple of blocks.
She'd walked the route, Eve thought. Family notification had to come first, but she wanted to walk in Lauren's footsteps, see what she'd seen. If she didn't know him, how did he choose her? He had to see her to want her, had to want her to choose her. At the bar? Is he from the neighborhood? Say he spots her, studies her, decides on her. Maybe he starts parking the vehicle along the route so she gets used to seeing it, doesn't think anything of it. She rolled it around and around as she crossed the bridge into Brooklyn.
Who's mommy?
That's gonna matter. If it represents a sexual thing, he'd rape her. Or she'd rape her if the killer's female. If mommy's mommy, that's 50-50.
Ew!
Didn't Octopus have a mommy deal?
Octopus?
I don't think they screw with their mothers. Do they know their mothers?
How do they know? Peabody wondered.
They all have weird heads and tentacles.
No, the guy with the complex, and the mother banging, and the eyes.
Oedipus, I think. I think Oedipus.
Octopus, Oedipus, all creepy. So maybe the perp wants to bang his mom, but mom isn't all about that, so he creates a substitute. Or she was, and that fucked him up, so a substitute. Or it's some other mom deal, and he doesn't want to bang her.
Why kill her once you create her?
She's not the real deal. And she's not banging him right. or giving him what he needs. She's not the original. He was always gonna kill her.
Why do you think?
Because he's shithouse crazy, Peabody. You don't do all this unless you're shithouse crazy. 10 days, 10 months, whatever. The crazy's gonna crack through the control eventually. The perfection of the tat, the piercings, the makeup, the hair, the clothes. That's control, precision. So he's got to have that. But under it, shithouse crazy. And following that logic, Peabody turned to Eve. He's going to need another substitute. Yeah, so let's hope he doesn't already have one picked out. Eve followed her in-dash directions to a pretty house with a pretty yard on a block of pretty houses and yards. Father's a mechanic, owns his own place, Peabody began. Mother's an artist. You saw some of her stuff in the Vic's apartment. She runs a local gallery. I guess both the Sibs are home from college for the summer. Somebody's probably home. Let's find out. Eve got out of the car and prepared to destroy someone else's world. By the time they'd finished, the emotional overload had a headache trying to drill through the crown of her head. She programmed coffee, black for her, regular for Peabody. They reminded me of my family. Peabody let out a sigh. Not free agers, but they're tight. They'll get through it, but nothing's ever going to be exactly the same. You can check out the couple of ex-boyfriends they gave us. If nothing else, it'll block that avenue. We'll take the bar next, then you can split off, check out the exes for what it's worth. I'll take the morgue. Morris should have at least started on her by the time I get there. Need to close off the avenue, Peabody agreed. But I can't see either of the exes they gave us. I think we're looking for older. So did she, but Eve glanced over at her partner. Why? It's that control and precision. It's not that somebody in their 20s or early 30s can't have it, and we've dealt with younger organized killers, but you add the control and precision with needing, almost for sure, a private space, a vehicle, and the killer could be female. Daughters have mom issues, too. She'd have to be strong enough to load a struggling or unconscious woman into a vehicle. Unless we have a team. And it could be siblings, even. Siblings. Eve considered it. Both obsessed, severely pissed, or sexually attracted to their mother? Not impossible. Interesting, even. Easier for two to do the snatch and grab, the transporting. But the kill was one stroke from the look of it. Then again, the second could have done the sewing up. You'd think that and the ribbon covering the wound could be signs of remorse, then the sign contradicts that. The sign was like a kid's printing, and with the thing. Crayon. Right, a kid thing. Made her pretty. Or his, her, their version of pretty. Dressed her up. Put her near a playground. Another kid thing. Who's mommy? His, her, their mommy. Is she still alive? Already dead? Mommy didn't have much fashion sense, Peabody commented. I mean, her clothes were just tacky. Cheap. Maybe she couldn't afford better ones. The jeans were ripped. I've seen pictures of my granny in jeans with holes in the legs when she was younger. A free ager thing? Don't all you guys sew? Wouldn't she sew up the holes or whatever? I don't know. Maybe it was a thing. I'll check into it. But the top,
really short, and all spangles, the shoes, really dressy and tacky, out-of-style shoes with the weird jeans, comes off kind of slutty, especially with the overdone makeup. Fashion might not have been Eve's area of expertise by a long shot, but she followed Peabody's line. Mommy could have been kind of slutty, which may be part of the issue. Or he, she, they see her that way. Or he, she, they want mommy to be slutty. I really need to talk this out with Mira. We've got to find the logic in the shithouse crazy, so we need a shrink. With the manager's cooperation, they spent an hour at Arnold's interviewing the co-workers. More tears, no new information, and more confirmation of Eve's sense that the victim had a solid, happy life, enjoyed her job, her circle. The bar struck her as solid as well, if a little pretentious. It wasn't the casual neighborhood place you'd belly up for a brew, but where you'd take a date to impress or a client to ply with a fancy drink served in a fancy glass on a table with low lights flickering in a little potted plant. It served tidbits like organic squash blossoms and goat cheese truffles. She couldn't see ever being hungry enough to put either into her mouth. When she said so, outside the bar, Peabody shook her head. They're pretty terrific, and the pancetta crisps are totally mag. You could make a meal. You make a meal. Later. Go into Central, check out the X's, update Detective Norman, and get me a time slot with Mira. I'm going to walk the Vic's route and back before I hit the morgue. They split off, and Eve walked in the not-quite-warm late spring sunshine. She saw some tourists, who never seemed to know how to actually walk on a sidewalk, several kids and babies in various pushcart things, a man walking a pair of tiny hairless dogs who could have passed for large rats. They yip-yip-yipped, darting at her boots as she passed, and the man scolded them in sugary tones. Now, now, sugar and spice, be good doggies. She saw well-maintained homes, tidy buildings, busy shops, restaurants with patrons sitting outside in the spring air, sipping drinks or having lunch. A few homes had front yards separated from the pedestrians by fences more ornamental than functional. Flowers bloomed or spilled out of pots on doorsteps. A team of three efficiently washed the windows on a duplex. A woman carrying a pair of market bags hurried up to the door of another. Traffic streamed by, almost pleasantly. It was hard to beat New York in the spring. Nothing could beat it for her at any time, but spring added some shine. She stopped in front of the victim's apartment again. Roy still had the privacy screens engaged. In the apartment below his, a woman sat on the windowsill, busily washing the window. It seemed to be the day for it. As she started back, she decided a decent vehicle parked along the route wouldn't cause attention. A beater now would, but a decent ride, a clean one? Who'd notice? And the Vic's block, especially the Vic's block, would be quiet at night. Almost entirely residential. And the restaurants would be shuttered, the bakery and deli closed. A 5-minute walk at night. A couple minutes more if she'd taken it at a stroll. Less if she'd jogged it. Home base. Familiar. No worries. And in seconds, it would only have taken seconds, everything changed. And all because Eve was sure of it. She'd look just enough like someone else. Bad mommy.
3. Eve walked the long white tunnel of the morgue, footsteps echoing. Her thoughts focused on the victim and that last walk toward home. Odds were she'd been at least a little tired and likely moving briskly. Young, in familiar territory, heading home in the night quiet of a good neighborhood. An easy mark for someone with a plan in place. The questions remained, why the plan? Why her? She pushed through one of the doors to Morris's domain and saw he had his sealed hands inside the chest cavity of her victim. Music murmured, something with a lot of low-note brass and a woman singing about love lost. He looked up, smiled. An early start on the day for you, and a very early end for her. He wore a blue suit, a bold color that told her his mood hit high. He'd matched it with a shirt the color of ripe pears and a tie that blended the two tones in subtle swirls. He'd braided his long dark hair in some complicated pattern that formed a coil at the back of his neck. He weighed an internal organ with easy efficiency. Eve moved closer, looked down on the body, naked and open now. I think her end, in a lot of ways, happened the night of May 28th. The lacerations and contusions on the wrist and ankle. Some would meet that date. Some are more recent. Shackled, and the cuffs would be 1¾ inches wide. Some other minor contusions, as you can see. The other ankle, the knees, elbows. The other ankle from banging into the shackle. Yes, and the others minor, as I said. Not consistent with violence. He didn't beat her, and he didn't rape her. There's no sign of sexual assault or consensual sex, not recent. Morris walked over to a sink to rinse the blood off his hands. She's very clean. Her hair, her body, recently and thoroughly washed. Her hair styled. The makeup, as you can see, very carefully applied. I think he had an image. And she was like a doll, you know? With a nod, Morris walked to his mini-fridgy, took out a tube of Pepsi for both of them. I do, and had the same thought. She was a form, and he used that form to create the image he wanted. Both the makeup and hairstyle are dated, as was the clothing. Were they? Now he grinned as he opened the tubes, handed her one. For someone who dresses so well, you have a sketchy knowledge of fashion and its history. Rourke's always putting stuff in my closet. How dated? Turn of the century, I'd guess, or the first few years of it. But it shouldn't be difficult to get a solid time frame. Where'd he get them? Did he have them already, and she fit the build, the size? Frowning, Eve circled the body. Maybe. Mostly fit, because the shoes were too small. Correct there. She'd have been closer to a size 8 than the 7½ of the shoes he put on her. Tougher to gauge a shoe size than clothes, I'd think. Jeans were a little tight. You can see where they dug in. Again, slightly off her size. So he already had them, or just needed her to be the size he wanted? Possibly. I can tell you that, other than being dead, she was healthy. No sign of illegal abuse, alcohol abuse. Her last meal, consumed about 5 hours before TOD, consisted of a few ounces